What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebound and Safety. Today, we've got an amazing lady talking about a really challenging time in her life and how she'd reacted to it and learned from it to help others. It's a really harrowing story, but it's a powerful story and it's one that maybe many of us need to hear. Let's jump into the intro and tell you some more about it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit subscribe, hit like, hit follow, blah blah blah, whatever positive looking button to help us on the algorithm thingamajiggy. Today we are talking to an amazing lady with a powerful and pretty harrowing story, which I think really helps to put context to the impact of stress and mental health in the workplace. And also she finishes off by giving us some tips and lessons that she'd learned essentially and how she helps organizations as well. So I really think this is going to be a powerful listen for you, but I also think it's going to be really helpful. I think this is probably a podcast that you might end up using bits of. So keep an eye out for clips and stuff that we might put out on YouTube for this. And I think this, if I'm thinking about how I might use this, it would be in some kind of stress awareness training or something like that, or a stress campaign or something. This is a powerful, powerful story. So please listen. I hope you enjoy it as much as you can, but ultimately I hope you get some support out of it and some ideas or some inspiration, and I hope it provides you some value. Before we get into it though, just a quick shout out to Paradigm Human Performance. Paradigm Human Performance are human organizational performance experts. They work around the world with some amazing brands doing some amazing work. They're a great team of people with experience in aviation, in the military, in rail, in nuclear, and so on and so forth. They're an amazing group of an amazing people doing some epic work. So if you're in a position where you're looking for some human and organizational performance experts to help you within your organization, then Paradigm is the place for you. You need to go and check them out. Ultimately, if you're not quite sure yet and you want to get to know them a little bit, or maybe you just want to watch some webinars or stuff, check out the Learning Organization webinar. It runs every other Thursday, and you can sign up to that on their website. Additionally, you can get access to the backlog, which is about 2 years worth of webinars. So go and check that out as well. All the details that you need in the description below. Thank you very much, Paradigm, for sponsoring Rebound and Safety YouTube and podcast channel. Don't forget to check out what we're doing. ProjectMilitium.com is the mastermind community for safety and risk professionals. So if you're looking to improve your continual professional development and actually have some real impact on your professional development and not just tick boxes, then 100% Project Militium is the mastermind community for you. We run weekly calls to help each other solve problems, to vent, to learn, to explore. We run philosophy calls, we run book clubs, we run quarterly events. There's loads of stuff that we do. We've also got some online courses coming out imminently. It's taken us longer than we thought to get that up and running, which will be free to members. They're included to members. And we're running the first month free of charge. So go check out projectmilitium.com. And finally, don't forget to check out rebrandingsafety.com, whether you're a brand trying to advertise to the safety and risk industry, or whether you're just a listener that needs some extra support from a consultant to take your next step in holistic risk management or culture improvement, or even just technical safety. We have consultancy services that can help you at Risk Fluent. So go check out rebrandingsafety.com. I'm pretty sure there is some way that we can help you. Without further ado, let's get into this conversation with the amazing Asha Burzon. You good?
Yep.
Cool. Asha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on. Before we get into our discussion, just want to give yourself a little introduction to kind of who you are and what you do, and then maybe we'll get into your story and have a good chat from there.
Okay, cool. So my name is Asha Burzon and I'm a clinical hypnotherapist and I specialise in solution-focused hypnotherapy.
Just quickly, what is that? What is solution-focused hypnotherapy?
Solution-focused hypnotherapy is where we use talking therapy So that kind of traditional method of talking to somebody about their emotions and their actions, and then combining that using the power of hypnosis. The difference between what I do and what traditional counseling does is I don't have to look at the past. So the client doesn't have to tell me about, you know, what that traumatic experience might have been, or they don't have to go over what the problems might have been, because actually what we know from more recent neuroscience is that that's not entirely helpful in some cases.
Right.
And so it's very much about saying to the client, well, you're here today, and what are we going to do? What's the person that you want to become, and how are we going to support you to become that person?
Yeah.
Change am I going to support you to make? What are those small little steps that you're going to take? And then, like I said, we use that wonderful stuff called hypnosis to allow that subconscious brain to that subconscious mind, I should say, to start thinking about putting it into play. So it's very different.
When we get into the hypnosis stuff, I'm probably just so naive around it that it just sounds, I feel like it's like therapy for Darren Brown, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no.
So no. You can just touch my forehead and I'm like,
yeah, no, none of that shit. None of that shit is going to happen. No, because, and I think that's the misconception, because it's stage hypnotism. Yeah. And with stage hypnotism, they're sort of subtly prepped before they go in. And there's a lot of effort that's put in to understand, you know, get a better feel for the audience. Oh, bless you. And the other thing about that is if you think about it, the person that's introverted, the person that doesn't like making a prat of themselves, the person that's very generally quite wealth, you know, tends to be quite reserved, they're not the person that's going to put their hand up.
Yeah.
You know, it's the person that kind of goes, yeah, me. I want to know what this crack is about. You're not going to be able to hypnotize me.
Yeah.
But actually, by the time you've put your hand up subconsciously, you've already consented.
Yeah. So you already kind of mentally prepped yourself to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Because from the moment you've said, yeah, I'll give it a go, your subconscious brain has heard, I'm giving it a go.
Yeah. So be ready for anything kind of thing.
Ready for anything. Because it comes back to that thing, doesn't it? Of, you know, when people say, don't think of a pink elephant. And like, all you can think about is a pink elephant. And that just comes back to your brain has to visualize the thing before it can disregard it.
Yeah.
So when you say, I'll give it a go, you're not going to be able to do that to me. The brain has to visualize it happening before it can disregard it.
Yeah. So it's fascinating when you, well, I love shit like that. Like it just, I love Darren Brown, if I'm honest. Like I think he's amazing. And I think there's a lot we can learn from him and those practices and like probably psychotherapy, as we'll find out today. But I remember listening, we were just talking about where I get my inspiration from with Joe Rogan. I was listening to him on the Joe Rogan podcast. And obviously Joe Rogan is a martial artist. So talks to loads of stuff around martial arts and stuff like that. And they ended up talking about self-defense, and Darren Brown was talking about, he was like, people don't understand how powerful the words can be when you know how to use them to make someone's brain react in a different way. So he was like, he said, I've been in this situation before where this lad basically came over and was 100% going to mug me. And come over, classic, like, give me a wallet. And Darren Brown just turned around and he said, you know what? I am sure that fence was 6 foot tall last time I saw it, but today it definitely looks 7 foot tall. You know, the red one. And the guy just kind of, what the fuck are you on about, mate? What are you on about? And he's like, give me your wallet. And he was like, no, honestly, I'm telling you now, it was 6 foot tall. And he said, the conviction and how you deliver it, your brain automatically goes, red fence, 6 foot tall. What's he on about? And he said, the guy turned around and went, you're fucking crazy, mate, and just walked off. And I was like, that's genius.
That completely makes sense, doesn't it? Because if you think about it, in his head, he had gone over with an intention. And that intention was to rob him, to take his wallet. And so he's gone over with this real conviction that that's what he's going to do. But then he's rocked up and he's, by using just something completely random, has broken his chain of thought.
Yeah.
Because he's now visualizing, like you said, that red fence being 7 foot tall, 6 foot tall, or wherever the fuck it was. And he's just like, hey, what? Yeah. And that was enough for his brain to almost not potentially stop what he's doing, but also to give him that break. And that was enough for the brain to kind of go, oh shit, maybe this guy's not all there.
Yeah, make you conscious in that moment. Yeah,
absolutely. Because when you're in that space where you're so focused, you're conscious, of course you're conscious, but you're very focused in that conscious present, aren't you? Yeah. And so by doing that, he's kind of thrown him, you know. So that's quite clever, actually. I quite like that.
Yeah, I'll never forget it. I love little stories like that. I'll never forget it. Yeah. And you know, all the shows that he does as well, like, you know, I talk about it a lot in my work. Like, I'm like, has anyone of you watched Derren Brown? And most people are like, maybe a little bit. Or you get the big fan like me, and they're like, yeah, love it. And like, you know, think about that. Like when he makes a guy push another guy off the roof. I don't know if you ever watched that one, but like he literally manipulates this guy into pushing this other gentleman or lady off the roof. And it is all just, it's kind of what we would call in safety or kind of resilience engineering would be like kind of normalized deviation. Really, it's like slight deviations from the rule. So he starts him off with just saying, you know, he starts him off by putting a person in authority. So and then by putting the main protagonist, I suppose, putting them down, so making them feel like, so it was little things like they turned up, he said, oh yeah, dress code is like is black tie, but everyone else was casual, or the other way around. So he feels like underdressed or overdressed. So he's already vulnerable, and then put him in a position of authority, put this other guy in a position of authority over me, the protagonist, and then being like, oh, try these vegan sausage rolls. We shouldn't really, because they're for vegans, but try them. So he's like, no, it's all right. And he's like, no, I know we shouldn't, but try it. And then, all right, fine. So he breaks one rule, and then the next rule gets a bit bigger, and the next rule gets a bit bigger. And the next thing you know, he's hiding a body, and then he's killing someone. And you're just like, what the? It is nuts.
Yeah.
Talk about the same at work.
Yeah, and that's exactly it, isn't it? Because if you think about it, it's that boundaries, isn't it? Yeah. You're constantly testing and pushing the boundary. And if you were to say, oh, go out and kill someone, you'd be like, what the fuck, dude? That's not me. That's not the shit. You know, that's not me. That's not what I do. Yeah. But like you said, what you're doing is you're really incrementally shifting his boundaries all the time. And by just doing that, then it becomes that normalized, doesn't it? You know, oh, that's normal for me to do that. And actually, that's normal for me to eat those sausages when I probably shouldn't. And it's actually, you know, that's a little bit outside my comfort zone, but now it's justified.
Yeah.
I hate the quotation marks. But, you know, it's justified. And so that's exactly how it can work. And there's a lot of prep work that would have gone into that as well, because obviously, you know, it's a show, so there'll be a lot of hypnosis that's given him suggestions.
Yeah, and they did like hand selected people, so they did this other exercise where they did the behind the scenes about like how that, not behind the scenes, but he said like how they'd prepped it is how they selected people was really interesting. Absolutely. So they got them into this room with the interview process, and they basically had a room of actors, because I said in theory, if you had a massive budget and you were trying to create behaviors within the workplace, you could do this. So basically you go into a room and six people in the room, there's seven chairs, six people of the chairs are full with people who are paid actors. And the seventh chair is me. I walk into the room, I'm not a paid actor. And then a bell rings and all the actors stand up. So I go, oh, maybe I should stand up then.
Stand up, yes.
And then the bell rings and I sit down. And eventually they just keep going and gradually remove the actors. But whenever they got somebody, a candidate in the room that didn't follow the rules, they removed them immediately. They removed them from the equation because they didn't want a dissenter. They wanted people that conformed to society.
Yes.
So he kept people in the room that did that. By the end of the room, by the end of the exercise, had no actors and seven chairs of people that stood up and sat down to the bell.
When that bell went. Yeah. That's exactly it, isn't it? Yeah, because if you think about it, our brain works best when there's no change. And so when we see a change and it's like, oh, crikey, okay, everyone stood up. Okay, then that's what I need to do, because we don't want to be different. Because from a survival perspective, back in the day, if everybody was running away say, from a lion, we're not going to be standing around going, well, that lion's not real. We're going to follow the crowd, aren't we? And that's how we conform, you know, and they are the ones then who are going to be, I wouldn't say more susceptible, but they are the ones that you then have the ability to start pushing those boundaries, yeah. You know, and start doing that.
That's what I am. Anyway, we didn't come here to talk about doing I sent us down a little rabbit hole there. So my apologies. But
I'm good. I'm all up for that.
I love this shit like that. I could just chat about it all day. Right. Do you want to tell us how you got into doing what you're doing now, Asha? That'd be interesting.
Do you want me to give you the whole story or do you want me to give you in bits?
That's a good question. Let's start off with the whole, you probably thought I should have thought about this, but I think let's go in with you're going to tell the whole story. And if I decide to interrupt you and ask a question, I'm just going to do that anyway, because I'm terribly rude.
That's fine. I'm all good with that. So I worked for an organization for about 17 years. I went into the organisation straight out of uni. It was something that I'd always wanted to do. I will say it was in the criminal justice field, but obviously because of everything else, I won't mention where and what it was and everything else.
Sure.
So I worked in the criminal justice field and I did that for about 17 years and I absolutely loved my job. There was like, I fucking loved it. I really believed in it. I was really proud of it as well. You know, it really meant something to me. And then I got an opportunity to take up a management post back in sort of 2009. And it was completely away from all my family and friends. And I decided that's what I was going to do. I wanted to change. So I left. So I left where I was living at the time in the Midlands and I moved down to the Southeast. Took up this post. And like I said, I love my job. We were really successful at what we did. We were really good at what we did. We won a couple of awards and everything was brilliant. And then I met my partner and he's lovely. He still is very lovely. And we, you know, bought a house, got married and all this, that, the other. And then we'd been trying to have a baby and weren't successful at it. And so we decided we were going to go down the IVF route. And at the time, I had sort of spoken to my manager because I understood the policies enough to know that I was going to need to take time out and I was going to need to go get injections and have appointments and all this, that, the other. And I knew that there were policies around that, around, you know, maternity and treatment and stuff. So I told my manager and said, look, one of the things that came up was that they mentioned that it might be because one of the reasons why I might not be conceiving is because I might be potentially stressed. But to be fair, when they said that to me, I kind of laughed. I just kind of dismissed it. I'm like, don't be ridiculous. I love my job. People who love their job don't get stressed. That was the sort of rationale in my head at the time. I was already managing quite a large team compared to most of my colleagues. So I was managing about 23 people at the time, whereas my colleagues only had about 12 or 13. And then about 2 weeks later of having this conversation and saying, look, you know, I need to take it easy. We're going to start IVF. And obviously IVF is fucking expensive because I was over 36. So I had to pay for it privately. And he said, yeah, sure. 2 weeks later, he kind of then came into the office at 4 o'clock on a Friday and went, yeah, we're kind of one manager down. Are you okay to cover this particular team? There are about 35 people. Are you okay to cover them for the next 6 weeks? I think it was the first time that I'd physically stopped, put my pen down and looked at him and just went, do you remember the fucking conversation we had 2 weeks ago? Like, and I think this is for me where I know something in me changed, because normally, James, I would be like, oh, yeah, sure, I can do that for you. Of course I can do that. Yes, I know my schedule's busy. Yes, I know I've got a lot on, but I can fit that in somewhere. But it was the first time I actually put my pen down and went, do you remember the conversation we had about 2 weeks ago about what I'm about to start doing in a couple of weeks' time from now? And he was like, yeah, but it's only 6 weeks. And, you know, that's not a lot. And they're quite self-sufficient. You're not going to need to do much. Anyway, about 4 or 5 days later, got up in the morning, going to get ready, and there was, I came downstairs and I was like, crikey, I got a bit of a headache. It was really bad migraine, actually. I'm probably underplaying it. Came downstairs, got myself ready, took some tablets, and went to the front door. And there was almost like there was a disconnect between my hand and my brain, because my hand was on the door handle, and I was like, should we get out? Should we just open the door and get out now? It's time to go. But my brain was just like, no, we're not going. We're just not fucking going. We're not going. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll have a cup of tea, make me feel better. So I went and sat down for a couple of minutes.
So on that point, your hand wasn't, you would, it mentally you open the door, but your hand was just not moving.
Yeah. In my brain, I was like, let's go. I'm going to miss the bus. It's time to go. My hand was just like, I was just holding it.
Really? Wow.
And it was probably for about 10 seconds. And then I thought, okay, maybe I'll take this morning off. I'll sleep, get rid of the migraine, and then I'll go into work this afternoon. And that went on for about 4 days, something like that. And then around the sort of fourth day, my husband said, look, you really need to go see the GP. You're obviously not in a good place. Something's going on. I've been telling you for ages, I think you're stressed. And so he obviously picked up the cues, and that happens a lot. Other people pick up the cues. You yourself don't see them. And so I was just like, nah, there's nothing wrong. We're not going to see the GP. And in the end, I went to see the GP. She said the same thing to me. Oh, I think you've got work-related stress. And I just looked at her and went, nah, I'm not stressed. How can I be stressed? I love my job and I've got a great life and I go to the gym and, you know, I'm always going out and I'm socializing and I'm doing this. People who are stressed or people who are anxious, they don't do these things because they're not capable of doing these things. I do all of these things. There's nothing wrong with me. She just said, look, just take a week off, take 2 weeks off. Just going to sign you off. Just take some time out. Don't worry about anything. You know, it's okay. So I conceded. I went, okay, fine. Maybe I'll just take a bit of rest. And then 2 weeks later, when I went back in, I was a blubbering wreck. I was crying my eyes out. You know, I couldn't control myself in terms of the feelings I was experiencing about the potential of going back into work. And then I just said to her, yeah, I'm in a really bad place. You know, and then it all sort of tumbled out of me, really. Once the sort of floodgates opened, you know, it then started to come out that I was probably going to bed at 11 o'clock, but then waking up at like 1, 2 in the morning and getting up and writing service level agreements because I was thinking about, well, I've got no other time during the actual working day to fit that in, and I'm awake now, so why not? So I was getting up, writing service level agreements at 2, 3 in the morning, and then going into work for 6, half 6, doing whatever I needed to do, staying there till 7. And I'd done that for about 18 months. I'd done that solidly.
For 18 months, getting a few hours sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And then I was waking up as well in the middle of the night thinking, did I do that piece of work? And, you know, given that I worked in the criminal justice field, the nature of the work can potentially be life or death.
Mm.
You know, so I'd be waking up in the middle of the night having a massive panic attack that did I sign off that piece of work? Did I do that piece of thing that I needed to do that would protect somebody or that would, you know, prevent any harm to someone? And so, yeah, like I said, when the doctor signed me off, I went back to see her. Everything came out, and then she signed me off for about sort of 12 weeks in the end. And I was regularly seeing her. I was seeing her probably about every sort of 2 to 3 weeks. And every sort of 2 to 3 weeks, I was just like, I'm just not ready. I don't know why, but I just don't feel ready. And so my employers at the time sort of said, look, you know, we've got an employment, the Employers Assist Program, the EAP scheme. So we're going to link you in with that and we're going to get you seen by somebody. So I was like, okay, fine. So off I went. To do this, and the bit that I've not forgotten, but the bit that's really important is that at the time of being also signed off, we'd had a miscarriage, and so, you know, it's almost that thing, isn't it, that thing of when your work life is hectic, you need the calmness from your home life. to sort of balance you out. And when your home life is hectic, you almost need your work life to be calm so that it balances you out. But that was the first time that both of those spheres were just chaotic, you know. And so when I went for the counselling, I was offered CBT because that's all they offered. And I did it and I refused to go back after the third session. I found it really unhelpful for me. I fully accept that for some people it can be helpful, but it was awful for me. It wasn't great. And I rang my employer and just said, look, I'm not going back. You know, this is the nature of the conversation I've had with this counsellor. And actually, it's been really distressing. And I think one of the things for me was that I was strong enough within myself to understand that the miscarriage wasn't my fault. But the nature of these conversations were, they were slightly suggestive of the fact that, well, because you're stressed, this is why you've had this miscarriage. And there was a sort of slight undertone in that sense. And, you know, I think when we were having a conversation before, in my head, I was like, God, it's a good job that I understand myself that it's not my fault. But, you know, if anybody else was in that place where they were blaming themselves, they weren't feeling that strong and they were even more vulnerable than me, you know, that would have been absolutely devastating. Mm. You know, that would have really undermined what they were trying to do. And so I did go back eventually, but that was more because I thought I was ready. I thought I wanted to get back to work and, you know, be productive and all of those sorts of things rather than I was ready to be back at work. And I had a chat with the employers and my doctor put me on phased return. Went back on phased return. And interestingly, my workload was exactly the same as it was when I was working full time. So I was like, okay. And they asked me to do something that I didn't agree with. And so I decided not. When I spoke to the GP said, that's ridiculous. And so she agreed to sign me back off again. Signed me back off again. And then we started this communication about going part-time instead. And then when I did go back after about sort of 5.5 months, 6 months in the end, I'd gone from this really busy, really purposeful, really meaningful job for me. I went from this really meaningful job to then being in this part-time role where I didn't really have any responsibilities. Nobody really knew what I was doing. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I almost became like this extra body that was in this organization. Sorry, I touched the micro on there. I became this extra body that was in the organization that was just picking up the slack, you know.
It become kind of transactional in a way.
Yeah, transactional in that I was just picking up stuff that other people couldn't do, but it just, there was no, I'd gone from having lots of goals, you know, lots of targets. This is what we're going to deliver. This is how it needs to be delivered. Planning it, scheduling it, speaking to staff about it, doing it, to then all of a sudden being in a situation where I was doing none of that.
Yeah.
You know, then it was just like I had this office, somebody would knock on my door and go, oh, can you please cover this for me? Or can you please do that for me? And it was really heartbreaking, you know, because like I said, I really, and I still do really believe in the organization and I love, you know, what they stand for and what they're trying to achieve, you know. And so for me to have spent sort of at that point, sort of 16 years, being so committed to it, I felt like they kind of had just chewed me up and spat me out, you know. And then I did fall naturally pregnant during that 6 month period as well. And
just to clarify, because I think that's really important point, and I know we you fell pregnant in the 6 month period that you were not at work.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was the first time when everybody else had been saying to me I was stressed, the doctor, my partner, my family, I was going, don't be ridiculous, I cannot be stressed because look at all these things I'm doing. And then when I had that downtime, I fell naturally pregnant, and it was the first time I really understood, hang on a minute, you know, there really is this connection between what I'm experiencing mentally and what's happening for me physically.
And that was not through IVF?
No, that was natural.
So you'd gone X amount of months / years thinking you just can't fall pregnant. There's something wrong between yourself or your husband or whatever, but something's not working there. So we're going to go IVF. Yep. But then you took 6 months off work and you naturally fell pregnant without IVF.
And that for me was really powerful because that was the first time I then started to realize, you know, I've had these breakdowns, I've cried, you know, and I've questioned, what am I doing, what this is about. But this is the first time I really understood how much my body had shut down. Mm. You know, because I was a massive gym fanatic. I went to the gym sort of like 4 times a week, you know, me and my partner, we used to love going to the gym. So we used to make it like a couples thing. We went to the gym, we used to go and chill in the sauna. We were always running about doing stuff. But it just never occurred to me that I really needed that downtime to switch off, to let that adrenaline and cortisol drop. And I was just constantly in that zone where it was just really normal. So then we fell naturally pregnant. And then I think I told you my little one decided he was going to come a little bit early, substantially early. But before he arrived, I decided to have some hypnotherapy because I was so petrified of miscarrying again. That I wouldn't even tell people I was pregnant. I didn't tell anyone. I just went into baggy clothes and I was so scared that I didn't tell anybody. And then I started hypnotherapy and that really helped me to kind of just get over it. And the week that I started to tell people, oh, by the way, I'm 6.5 months pregnant, about to be 7 months pregnant. And everybody was like, oh shit, you've got a bump. And I was like, yeah, it's not because I'm a fat git. It's a baby. But because I'd been wearing such loose clothes and then all of a sudden I'd rocked up one day in a dress that, you know, you could see the curve of the bump. Everybody was like, oh shit, you're pregnant. And I was like, yeah. And I'm like nearly 7 months pregnant. And they were like, what? Yeah. And it literally was like that. And that was the week I told everybody. And that was the weekend I went into labor because that's just fucking son's law. But the hypnotherapy all throughout really helped me because you know how we've just been talking about the whole Darren Brown thing about understanding the words that you're telling yourself, understanding where you're focusing your energy. Mm. You know, and for me, I was focused on the fact that they've told me this baby is coming. So there's sweet FA I can do about it. So I need to do everything in my power, A, to hold on to it, him now, hold on to him for as long as I can. And B, when he does arrive, I'm not going to have fucking time to sit around wallowing. I'm not. I'm either going to have to enjoy every moment because he, you know, we don't know if he's going to be staying. So I need to do everything I can to enjoy every moment. And at the same time, I need to do everything that I can to make sure he gets that best care and attention. And, you know, I'm really thankful for the team. Am I allowed to say where he was born?
Yeah.
Okay. At the Royal Berkshire Hospital. And it was the Buzzcott unit, which is the special care baby unit. And honestly, James, I cannot thank them enough for everything that they did. Not just for looking after him, but also looking after us. Yeah. You know, just, you know, because as you can imagine, when my son was born, I could measure him from here to here.
Oh, my God.
And he was about 1 kilo.
Blimey.
I think he was 1.55 kilos at the time when he was born, and I was so scared. And when they dealt with him and did everything they needed to, they said to us that you can come up after about 3 hours and see him, and they let me hold him. I was so scared because he was so fragile.
Yeah,
you know, he was like a broken doll. Yeah. You know, he was so fragile, really floppy. You know, and it was just like it was really scary. But they let me put him on my chest, my bare chest. But yeah, so I mean, kind of going off a little bit, but you know,
just to clarify, your boy is with us now, isn't he?
He is. He's 7. He's amazing. He's probably one of the most gentlest and funniest souls that I've ever been blessed to know. So yeah, he's an absolute gem. He's a real star. And yeah, so then I just decided, you know what, after he was born, I had a real reality check and it was like, I don't need to go back there. And the thing that did it for me was all throughout when I was in hospital after he was born, when I was, you know, in and out of the hospital looking after him, because he had to stay in intensive care for 3 months. Not once did a colleague or my line managers get in touch to check in on me. Not once. Not even a, are you okay? Is there anything that we can do for you? We're just thinking about you. It must be really hard for you at the moment. And especially as they all knew we had no family and friends nearby. Mm. You know, and so that was the time where I realized this organization just really doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And so it's time to go. And so it was the fact that I'd had that hypnotherapy that it was like, actually, I can retrain in something that still allows me to help people to become who they want to be, you know, and live the life that they really want to live. And so I retrained. We moved up to the Midlands because we wanted to be closer to family. And then I signed up with the school for hypnotherapy. And I specifically chose that school because I'm very logical. Mm-hmm. I like science.
Yeah.
And this particular school is very heavy on neuroscience. And that's who I lecture for now as well. So, yeah, full circle.
There we go.
Yeah, full circle.
Thank you very much for telling us the story and honestly and openly as well, because I think it's a really powerful story, but also it's a hard story to listen to, so it must be even harder to tell. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate that. And I think others will as well, particularly women, I think, that are going through similar things. Because I you know, we've had our first little, and that alone, you know, it was a pretty simple birth. My wife might not say that, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, it was quick. You know, Maggie was in and out in a few hours. And it was fairly simple, but, you know, I just remember how stressed we were. And that was just the normal birth with a normal job.
And you know what's really interesting, James, is actually the number of, I think when people think of post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. they assume it's going to be war veterans or people on front line. Actually, the highest rate of post-traumatic stress disorder actually comes from childbirth.
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, completely. Because if you think about it, the person that you love is potentially, you know, giving birth. And then on top of that, you've got the baby that you've already got an attachment to as well.
Yeah.
You know,
it's kind of a bit of a soapbox for me, because it is uber hard for a woman to give birth. Like it is just unbelievable. And my hat goes off to every female in the world that ever gives birth. It is just the pain that I saw in the face of my wife. I was just like, wow, this is the strongest thing I've ever seen anybody do. And I have the utmost respect for anyone that gives birth. But I do think that we don't allow men to say how difficult it was for them. I think it's a really hard process for men. And I found it really difficult to be completely helpless. Or my wife will say you weren't helpless, because I was a punch bag basically and a squeeze, you know, body for her, like a stress ball basically. But you know, you feel utterly helpless, and I'm assuming that, you know, you're in that room because you love that person, and you're seeing the person that you love in excruciating pain, and there's nothing you can do about it. And really, there's nothing the healthcare system can do about it. Like, yeah, you can have like drugs and stuff, but ultimately, yeah, my wife was high as a kite. Like the stuff she was saying, she would never say again. She was
asked, but I don't want to put you in the spot or bless her, ruin her confidentiality. So we won't.
She was high AF. She was just like the stuff she was calling Maggie. At one point they went, "Have you got a name for her?" And she went, "Yeah, arsehole." Because she was in so much pain.
Oh my God, can you imagine looking at that on a birth certificate?
So good. And
McPherson. Oh God, sorry.
Arsehole McPherson, I think, would be. Yeah. That's basically what people call me anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think that, like, I talk to my wife about this quite a lot. And I mean, maybe one day I'll try and raise some awareness around it if I get some time, but it's it's like, I remember going to, we'd had Maggie not for a few months, and we're going to like a summer barbecue, and there was a lady of a certain generation, I'll say, that was like, was it hard for you, James? And if she wasn't a friend of the family, I'd have turned around and gone, yeah, bitch, it fucking was. So do you want to lose the tone? Like, just because it's hard for me doesn't devalue how hard it is for Sherry. Like, they're two separate things. And it's a, I think, to your point, I think it's a traumatic experience for both people going through it.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? You know, so I'm sorry that, you know, your other half, I've forgotten her name, Sherry, bless her, had a really tough time during birth. And, you know, it doesn't have to be painful. Which might kind of sound like, what? But actually, as humans, that's how we're designed to give birth. And what's happened over the God knows how many years, but, you know, over the last sort of 200 years or so, because it's become medicalized, the intervention that's taken place has meant that the way that we would naturally give birth, we haven't capitalized on it. So, for example, when I had my son, when I had Michael, you know, I wasn't allowed to move. I had to stay on my back because every time I moved, they would lose his heartbeat. Yeah. And obviously with everything that was going on, they needed to make sure they had his heartbeat. Now I've got, I fractured my coccyx many years ago. So as you can imagine, lying on my back for 4 days solid, by about day two, I was crying because I was in so much pain. But for me, my brain understood I had to override the pain, deal with the pain and accept it because they needed to make sure he was okay. And that's what I was going to do. But sort of going back to that point that, you know, there's a real thing, isn't there, that just because one person's two people can be in the same room and have very different experiences and still come away with, like you said, you know, different types of trauma, you know, from the event. But, you know, I'm like I said, I'm really sorry that Sherry had a tough birth because it actually didn't need to be.
Yeah, she did. We did a lot of the hypnobirthing stuff prior. Some stuff worked and some stuff didn't. I think yeah, each to their own.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important because, you know, I know of people who have done hypnobirthing and they've had a fantastic experience. And then equally, I've known of people that haven't had such a great experience with it as well. And I guess that's like with any form of hypnobirthing, isn't therapy. But when you're doing that kind of intervention, it's gonna depend, isn't it?
I don't want to get too much into a conversation on this because it kind of moves away from where we're going, but I do think it partially become a bit too commercialized, in my opinion. Like, I looked at a lot of the stuff that Sherry, like, so we were both doing this kind of course together through a very popular lady. There's like one lady who's like the biggest hypnobirth lady.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
And you know what? Fair enough. She met sort of managed, she's good at her job and stuff, but I was kind of like, what she tried to do through this course that we did, it was kind of like an introduction to hypnobirthing. Like, I think it needed to come with a caveat to say, this is not enough for you to go and do it yourself. I don't know. That was just my opinion. Like, looking at it, basically what they were teaching is similar to like mindfulness and Buddhism and stuff like that, is kind of accepting the pain, dealing with the pain and breathing and just, you know, I remember that from mindfulness stuff I did, you know, they say, hello, fox. And even though you're the rabbit and the fox is a threat, you say, oh, hello, and just accept that's what it is. And that takes years of training, years of training. And we did a few months of a course, and I was just like, I thought it was a bit dangerous, in my opinion. But you know what, Sherry, if it wasn't for the breathing, I think that we learned through that. Yeah. I think that really helped. I think that helped Sherry a lot through that.
Yeah.
I don't want to go into a hip.
No, absolutely, because that's not what we need to talk about. But yeah.
But what I did want to touch on, a couple of things from your kind of story, and one thing that keeps coming up to me was the importance of really building relationships with your team. So I would kind of define your situation at work as kind of like high functioning stress and anxiety. Like, you're still doing your job, you're still smashing your goals, you're still smashing your objectives. And I think traditionally managers have this, not just managers, I think generally everybody, most people have this common misconception that stress is just, if I'm stressed or anxious, I'm I'm depressed in a corner and I'm just crying all the time. I'm not functioning properly. I can't go to work. So I don't think the system is educated enough to pick up the fact that you were smashing all of those KPIs, but to the detriment of your own health. And I think the importance for me is understanding that a manager and an employee, the relationship there is vital. And like I talk at it from a point of view when I'm working with clients, I talk to it from a point of view of like, you know, where's your unknowns? If you haven't got a good relationship with your employee now is an unknown. But if you have a good relationship, what's going on in that person's personal life now becomes a known, and you can now acknowledge whether it's a risk to your organization or not.
Okay, absolutely.
And I think from that, no, I was just going to say, sorry, like from that point of view, like how much of a difference do you think it would have made if you had that close personal relationship where we didn't do the thing that we do so much now, which is separate personal and professional? They're like, they're two completely different worlds. No, they're not. Like, do you think that would have made, particularly on your return to work, I think that would have made a massive difference. I don't know what your thoughts are around that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a couple of elements in that. The thing about the high functioning anxiety, completely agree. Yeah. Because the way the high functioning anxiety works is that you're a people pleaser. That's me. You're very conscientious. That's me. You're somebody that follows the rules. That's me. You're somebody that thrives on other people's praise. So your validation doesn't come necessarily from yourself. That comes from other people. That used to be me. And so it's one of those that when you're in that situation as a high functioning person, you will do everything that you can to maintain the status quo and say, actually, look at how good I am and what I'm capable of doing, because there's an element of that imposter syndrome in there. Yeah. You know, and so there can be that kind of correlation between the two. And I think the other thing for me is, which I didn't think of at the time, but it came to me afterwards as I started to get better and start looking after myself, was, you know, where the hell have I got this from? And actually, it comes from the conditioning that I grew up with, you know, which is, my parents always taught me, you respect your elders, you respect authority, you know, you do everything that you're supposed to do that your manager asks, because you be a good employee. And so there was this kind of cultural conditioning, and I'm going to use cultural really loosely, because family dynamics are very different in different families. And, you know, so when I talk about culturally, I mean my family culture, you know, and the generation.
Well, caveat.
Yeah, absolutely. It has to be in there. The two generations above me were people that worked on the markets. So my dad, my granddad, you know, they all worked on the markets. But my uncles, they all went to uni. Yeah. And my auntie went to uni in the 70s. And so, you know, that was really unusual, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s. And so there's that element of that conditioning. So, yes, when you're high functioning, unfortunately, that also then means there's a lot of masking, because you're not that person that's going to ask for help.
No.
Because you don't want to then be seen as a failure, because you people please. Yeah. So not only are you taking on more work, but you're now pretending that everything is okay. You know, so it's very difficult, I think, potentially for line managers to be able to then see that. And I think that's where, as an organization, it's about understanding, what does this person's work stream look like versus how many hours they're physically trying to work? You know, because my line manager was signing off my timesheet every month. He could see I was coming in at 6:30. He could see I was staying till 7:30. So that in itself would have been enough to evoke a conversation. Yeah. What's happening here, Asha? What's this about? You know, turn this around. But, you know, what's this about? Why are you coming in so early and, you know, staying so late? What's going on? Yeah. You know, so I think, yes, there is that. And yes, I think absolutely, you know, when I went back to work, there was almost in a negative way, actually, to my detriment, that it was like, well, we don't know if she's going to cope now. Yeah. So rather than having the conversation with me about what can we do to help you, it was kind of a, look, you know you've had a really tough time. This is what we're going to do for you. And there you go, because we want you to take it easy now, you know, and that kind of felt like a bit of a slap in the face, you know, because as you've, you know, as I've mentioned, if you're somebody who's been high functioning before, to then all of a sudden be in a space where you're not doing anything purposefully, it can feel really hard.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, absolutely.
No, just because my camera's going to die, so I need to change the battery.
No, that's okay.
Normally we don't need to do that, but I was on a call this morning with this, so that smashed that battery as well.
Right.
I'm on a two battery cycle. One gets charged, the other one's in the camera.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah. Well, you can buy, apparently you can buy a battery that plugs in, so you don't have to do that, which is my next investment. But anyway, yeah,
it's worth it. No, it's okay. But yeah, so that, you know, from an employer's perspective and an employee, line manager, you know, CEO, managing, and actually, I want to also make that point that I was a line manager, and it's not just about me, and it's not just about the employees, because employees are across all grades. You know, and so the CEO deserves as much care and as attention as the kitchen porter or the admin staff, you know, whereas I think generally we tend to work on the basis that when we think of staff, we're thinking about operational staff.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? And I think that can sometimes get a bit lost, because that's how it felt for me, that I was like, well, I'm a line manager and I have to be a certain way. You know, I have to take all this on and I have to be seen to be doing all these things. So, you know, absolutely with employers, they should be, you know, learning more about them and doing what they can to support them.
I think another thing as well that comes from that is that the importance of, like, I have this really annoying thing that I say every single day that people seem not to pick up on yet. Blanket approaches do not work.
Yep.
Like, so, and particularly when it comes to people. And honestly, yeah, if I sit in one more meeting where we're talking about mental health and the only solutions we've got are blanket approaches and they're, let's get some mental health first aiders, and I'm not devaluing mental health first aiders, I think they're very good things, and I think they're, more organisations should have them. However, they are not the solution. They are first aid. So you wouldn't go, hey, you know, the HSC have just turned up and we want to talk about safety at work. And you go, oh, yeah, cool, we've got some first aiders. You wouldn't do that for safety, would you? But that's what we're doing for mental health right now. But anyway,
that's a really good analogy, actually. I really like that.
It's the same thing. And it just, I was in a meeting with a load of quite senior bodies in Northern Ireland. And that was all they're talking about, mental health first aiders. And I said, look, I said the exact same line. If we turned up in a company, we're doing nothing for safety other than first aid, what would you say? I said, well, we're in breach of the health and safety at work act. I said, yeah, so why are we only talking about mental health first aid now? We need to be talking about the systems, the environment that we're creating that is causing this stress. But anyway, I think to kind of come to that point, I think it's really important. And this is what I try to do with customers and clients is to take a people-centered approach. And people think that sounds really hippy-dippy and really hard and really chaotic, because people are chaotic and messy and we're all different. But ultimately, it's just understanding that person. What's the risk to you? What's your personality like? So we can tell that Ash is a people pleaser. We know she's going to hit all of those goals. So the stress indicators for Ash are going to be completely different from someone who's got different cultural background, different personality traits, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I think that's really important.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's really important, because this blanket approach is just ridiculous. You know, it's no different if somebody was to, you know, fall over and we all go, oh, look, they've definitely broken their leg, but we've got no idea where they've broken it, how they've broken it, and what's the best way to fix it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Oh, we'll just stick a cast on because that's the best thing to do. Well, no, it's fucking not, because actually it might need surgery because it's splintered and there's a risk that there's going to be an infection. You know, so it's about businesses starting to understand that, number one, a blanket approach is not going to work. And yes, that might mean that you need to change the way that you do things. But all progress is built on change. And we cannot continue with this approach of, oh, we have an EAP scheme, so sorry, that's where you go and that's where you need to be seen. And if it doesn't suit you, well, tough, you'll have to pay for it privately, you know? And I think I really, I have to take a really deep breath sometimes when I go into business meetings and I kind of get, oh, well, we have an EAP scheme and that's what we're going to be offering. And it's like, and we have the mental health first aider, because I have the same issue that you do. Because anecdotally, actually, the impact that they've had on in terms of preventing mental compromised mental health is actually negligible. It's very, very minimal. So for the amount of money that's been invested in this rolling out of mental health first aiders versus the outcomes, the output, the consequences, the results, marginal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely marginal.
I think there's such a great irony in it when we're like, right, what's our solution to stress at work? Oh, we got an employee assistance program and we've got mental health first aiders. Okay, cool. So why have you got them? Oh, because if somebody gets stressed, we want to give them help. Okay, cool. Are you acknowledging that you stress them out then? Is that what you're saying? You are causing that stress.
Yep.
Well, no, I just feel like we should do it. So you should do it. So you're just doing it for compliance, or are you doing it to reduce stress? Which one is it? And I could tie people in knots with stuff like this. And we come back to the point where we go, because ultimately what you're doing is you're doing what you think is right. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. I respect that you've acknowledged that you need to do something. And I respect also that what you've done is just look at what everybody else is doing and gone, let's do that. That's what we should do. And I also respect that I think a lot of people won't admit it, but they're really scared of dealing with this. I think they look at stress and they're like, and I remember being there myself. I remember being on my first safety qualification and a very stuck up, naive young man and saying, I don't understand how we're going to deal with stress. I don't think it's fair to ask an organization to deal with stress. I remember saying that, and I will never, ever forget the gentleman that was who was a senior position for the police force in that area and turned around and said, we have a duty to manage this, because he said, I've got one detective at the moment who's running a child abuse case, and the two children in this particular case that he is running are two twin young blonde girls, and he has two twin young blonde girls. So he has to be able to do that job and completely disconnect those two worlds and then go home and not be so stressed out and look at his daughters and be able to love them and not think of that. And he said, if you were to sit there and say it's not the organization's problem to deal with stress, he said, I would do nothing for that guy. And he would just go home and just what? He would have nothing. And I'm so grateful that I said that in that course and that that man was there, because it was in that moment that I was like, okay, yeah, I get this. And we need to do something about this. Because if I hadn't, I'd have gone years and years thinking that if he wasn't there, because the tutor didn't have much to say about it.
And I think it goes back to that that point that you made earlier about, you know, we don't leave our personal lives at the door. Mm. And for some of us, when we come home, and especially with all this homeworking shit that's been going on, we don't leave work at work either. You know, we know that rates of burnout have gone up by something like 221% over these last 18 months, since sort of last March. Mm. You know, we know that rates of domestic abuse have gone up by 40%. We know that grooming of children online has gone up, you know. So we've got all these things that, as parents or carers or as single people, that we're trying to manage at the same time while trying to remain effective at work. Yeah. You know, and I mean, I went to a networking event yesterday, and there was an organization, and they were talking about mental health in the workplace. And one of the ladies' questions was, and it just reminded me of what you were saying, was, well, you know, what's stopping an employer from dismissing somebody who's burnt out and stressed and getting new staff in? You know, why not just do that? You know, what's stopping them from doing that? And sort of, bless them, they were answering the question, but I don't think she necessarily got what they were trying to convey to her. So I said, look, if you don't mind, is it okay if I answer? I said, look, ultimately, there is something that's in that work culture, the way that's been set, something set up. It's the work culture, it's the work stream, it's the way that they might work, it's the policies that they might have in place. Whatever it is, it sounds like there might need to be a complete overhaul in that situation, a proper person-centered assessment of what's going on. Because essentially all that's going to happen is that person who's skilled and experienced will leave, yeah. Okay? Never mind the human costs to them. We'll talk about those in a minute. But in addition to that, the new member of staff's going to come in. They're going to get skilled up. They're going to get experience.
Right.
But all that's going to happen is that same level of stress is going to hit them at some point.
Yeah.
And what then's going to happen is they're going to leave again. And so we're going to get caught up in this vicious cycle. So that's why organizations absolutely have a duty of care to ensure that they are doing whatever they can to manage that stress. You know, and, you know, we know, you know, you and I know that companies that do, I wouldn't even call it the extra mile, but companies that treat us like humans, that treat their employees like humans, they are going to get that person staying with them longer because they're going to remember. You know, if you think about everything I just told you about what happened in my story, the thing that then made me realize I needed to leave was the fact that no fucker rang me, texted me, checked in on me to see if I was okay or to see if my baby was still alive.
Yeah.
Now that, to this day, all throughout that story, I was fine, right? But that now is making me A, angry and emotional. But, you know, the rest of it, I was okay telling you, but that's the difference. They lost 17 years of experience. All that training, all that additional work they had put into me, they lost it.
Yeah. And I think it's such an interesting point because I think a lot of the time, and you know, I think we see symptoms of this as well on LinkedIn. Like, how many times do you see the LinkedIn police come out and be like, I don't want to see a post about your personal life, please. This is a business platform. And yeah. I'm like, dude, if you haven't worked out that they're one and the same, then you got a fucking long way to go because, you know, and I'm worried for the people that you employ. If you think it's that clear cut that I can just disconnect from home and come to work and focus, because it doesn't work like that. And I think that you can see that on LinkedIn. And so therefore, you know, it still exists, but ultimately as well, like I understand that I think some employers and I've helped organizations through this exact problem. People have personal issues that can infect the work, impact the workplace, that can be out of control of the workplace, and I think that's important to acknowledge. And I think that you as an organizer, how I would kind of help an organization if I was doing that, and I'd be interested on your thoughts. Is okay. Step one is let's look if we're contributing to the problem. Let's try and find out if we're making this worse, because if we are, this poor guy or girl is really having a bad time, right? Two, well, probably one, actually, probably zero would be, do we even know about this stuff? Do we have the relationships with these people, with our employees, to actually know, for them to say, I'm having real problems at home and it's impacting my work? We might not even know that, but let's assume we do know that. Are we contributing to the problem would be point one. Point two would be, okay, we're pretty comfortable with where we are. And within that process, I think we're talking to the person. We're trying to find out if we're making it worse. And it's important that we're doing it with them. That it's a collaborative approach, I think. And then I think the next point to say is, how far are you willing to take this as an employer? Like I would say to a customer, how far are you willing to take this? Because if this is a personal issue and it could impact your workplace, it's up to you. Like, you can really make the decision right now. Am I going to invest in this person? Am I going to pay for therapy because they probably can't afford it? Am I going to try and help them with this to keep them? I think that's a better decision, because I think ultimately that person is going to love you forever and they are going to stay with you forever. But ultimately, I also acknowledge that a company might not be financially or even economically stable enough to do something like that. But I don't know what your thoughts are around where you've got a personal issue that really is out of the control of the organization, how an organization should maybe deal with it. I've probably oversimplified it, but I'd be interested on your thoughts.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a really important question, isn't it? And, you know, I was working with an organization where they had a young they employed a lady, and she had severe history of trauma that was related to children and birth and stuff. And they asked, invited me in to do some sessions with her on a one-to-one basis, because they'd had the conversation, very similar to what you described, actually, you know, had the conversation and said, look, we're a family firm. And we're very much that everybody that works for us is part of this family. And that's what we do. We look after each other. And so when they invited me in to work with her, sort of like, I think a year had passed of this sort of absence, unexplained absence and what have you. And what then became apparent was that she needed some support. And so they specifically sought out what I did. And I started seeing her, and there was almost like every sort of, because I work in sort of blocks of appointments. And so every time we'd come to the end of that block of appointment, there was a conversation about, you know, where is she at? Obviously with her consent, you know, about confidentiality and stuff. So checking in, look, where is she at that she's showing you? You know, this is what she's given me consent to share with you. This is where we're at. This is what we're doing. And there was this kind of, every time there was a kind of a, we're not quite sure how far we can take it. Because of that, you know, we're a small company. So there is that understanding, isn't there? And it must be really tough as well for employers from that perspective. And, you know, fair play to them. They went, I would say, above and beyond in that sense, supporting this person. And one of the things I was having a conversation with them about frequently was, look, I can't guide you on this because I'm a therapist at the end of the day. You will need to be speaking to your health and safety person because of that understanding of psychological safety at work. Because one of the things that we talked about was the breathing exercise, allowing her to be able to take herself away so that she could go and do that breathing exercise. So she could work through that panic attack and then come back and continue with her work, which worked wonderful for her. And she was actually really grateful for that. And then at the same time saying, look, you need to speak to your health and safety person, but also you need to speak to your HR department, you know. And that's the difficulty, really, because as an employer, they probably went, I would say, four times over than what they had planned to do. You know, they did that plan of action with me four times in terms of what we were going to do, how we were going to continue to move her forward. And the difficulty is, though, James, is that when you're in that place where you feel like your mental health is compromised or stretched, the difficulty that's going to remain for businesses, HR and health and safety is that everybody's journey, I hate that word, but everybody's journey to getting to a place where they feel better is going to be very different. You know, I've worked with another person who had a very similar situation, and after four sessions, she was able to move forward with the way that she wanted to move forward. And I think that's the difficulty that businesses are going to have, you know, and it's really difficult to answer.
Yeah. Like they don't know today, is it going to take four sessions? You're going to take 400 sessions. And then once you're in it, so like you can say, you as an organization say, no, I really care about James. So I want him to stay. I think, you know, we really like him. We're a small company. We've got a close relationship and I want to look after him, and we've got a bit of money. So I want to help him out. But then what if that turns into 400 therapy sessions? And I suspect once you're in it and you've started helping him and you're seeing the development and James is improving, but ultimately you've then got this pure guilt as an organization to be like, if I cut this now, it's all James has got.
Yeah. And that's exactly where this organization were at, because they were like, well, I work in blocks of six. We were only looking for six. Okay. We think she might need 12. Okay. We'll do the 12. And then they did it four times over, you know, and they understood. And I was saying to them, look, you have to do what you think is right. I can tell you from the conversations that we've had that, you know, she's recovering from a trauma and that might take a bit of time. I can't tell you how long that's going to take. And that's where I think is really difficult for businesses. And you know, I don't think there's a full answer. I think also, and that's why I say HR are probably the people to best guide us, because then we've also got the Disability and Discrimination Act as well, because once you've been diagnosed with something, you know, then you're looking at the legislation around that as well, aren't you, ultimately?
It's an interesting relationship, I think. I think a lot of organizations are struggling to work out who deals with stress.
Yes.
And like, one minute I'm involved, next minute HR is involved, one minute HR is running it, then I'm running it. And I think a lot of safety professionals go through that same thing. Ultimately, it's a risk to the organization, and it's an operational risk. You know, the health of the employee is an operational risk. So therefore, I think it sits in the safety. However, there are aspects of it that we 100% need to collaborate with HR. And there might be a HR person that listens to me say this and think, no, you're totally wrong. And that's fair enough. If they agree, please come on the podcast and we can talk about this. But ultimately, I see HR. Do I want to say this? I see HR as a primarily I'm trying to work out how to say this. I've backed myself into a corner now. Only in my experience with HR, I see them very much as a transactional process to protect the organization and the employee to a certain extent. But ultimately, I see the majority of HR departments, in my experience, exist for the employee, the employer, not the employee. Whereas my experience of my profession, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of people in my profession that focus solely on the compliance side, but I think safety is taking a shift to focus heavily on the employee than they are on the employer. I might be completely wrong about that. And maybe there's a rebranding HR podcast out there somewhere.
I think you're in touch with some really good HR people, actually. And it's really interesting because I find that with smaller businesses, their ethos is slightly different, especially with the newer established younger CEOs. There's a real kind of understanding around the importance of not feeling like, oh, it just sits here and it just sits there. It's about understanding. Actually, it sits with all of us. Me as the CEO, the culture that I create.
Holistically.
Absolutely. Completely. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of new businesses that I've been speaking to and seeing, and you can see that they're starting to understand that it's not just about, oh, it sits here and it sits there. There's not this kind of real kind of categorical boxing of people. It's very much about understanding, actually, we need to work collaboratively because we're going to support this person going forward.
I totally agree on that. And I wish you'd have said that before I started slagging off.
No, that's okay. Because we have different, we do, don't we? And we have different businesses. We have those much more older and established businesses who are the ones, as we said, tend to sort of kick back against recognizing that stress happens in the workplace and people will bring their stress from outside into the home. But, you know, we are not, it's a completely different, it's going to be a potential Pandora's box, but we haven't even taken into account people working from home, you know.
Yeah, and we definitely don't have time to get into that.
That's why I said it's a completely different Pandora's box, isn't it?
That's episode two of us. Yeah, no, definitely. I'm conscious of time, Asha. I'm conscious it's a Saturday as well. And we have been talking for an hour and 10 minutes and 20.
We did this shit, innit? We can talk, me and you. We did this last time.
I could talk for England, me. So, and you know, when you get someone who's passionate about their project and their profession like you are, like that's just the perfect guest for me, because I can just sit and talk and ask questions and throw opinions out there and see what the expert thinks and go from there. Like, and I just, that's why I do this. I love it. That's
good.
Good.
Thank you for having me on. It's been really good fun. It's a good way to spend a Saturday morning.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. That's nice to hear. That's nice. That's good feedback. I like that. If people wanted to do some work with you, Asha, can you just give us a quick run through kind of what that looks like, what you do, and then how they get hold of you?
Yeah, sure. So obviously off the back of my own experience in terms of what happened after I set up my private practice, I was really, really passionate. I genuinely don't want people to go through what I went through. And genuinely, I don't want businesses to lose that qualified experienced member of staff. And so for me, what I've done is I have created a couple of products. So there's presentations, there's workshops, but there's also a CPD accredited training program that I've developed where people actually learn and understand the basics and the fundamentals about mental health. Because if you can start to understand what your stress cues are, if you can understand what it looks like when you're not coping, you have the ability then to start putting the things into place to start looking after yourself. And that's why it's about that proactive, that preventative taking care of ourselves. Because absolutely, as we've been saying all throughout, there is that organizational duty of care to look after us. And equally, we have to take part. You know, we have to take some responsibility for doing that too as well. And so I run, like I said, workshops, I do short presentations, and I do CPD accredited training. And then for those employees who, unfortunately, that presentation or that workshop isn't enough, they need that one-to-one support, then I also do one-to-one hypnotherapy for them as well. So I'm very much person-centered or business-centered. So usually I go in and say to them, look, what's going on? And off the back of that, it's really interesting because sometimes I'll ask them, have you had more people signing off because they've been experiencing lots of muscle ache or IBS, or they're talking about chest pains, or they're talking about migraines or not being able to sleep? Because not everybody's going to go to the doctor and get themselves signed off. It can be those symptoms of high functioning anxiety, generalized anxiety, you know, all of those kind of indicators that suggest our mental health is compromised and stretched. And so if people can start saying, well, actually, I have been having more migraines, and actually I have been waking up, and yeah, I've been a right cow to my other half lately, you know, or I'm always screaming at the kids and I hate it when I do. You know, it's just those little cues that if you can learn what they look like, you're able then to start putting that work into place and really focusing on it. And like I said from the beginning, everything I do is based on neuroscience, so I can explain to you how that works, why that works, and why it's really important for all for us to be able to do that for ourselves.
Awesome. And best way to get a hold of you would be your website?
Either through the website or just drop me an email. Do I need to send you my details or do I say them here? Because
you can say them here and send them to me and I'll put them in the description for everyone.
Cool. So my email address is asha@inspiredtochange.biz. Still can't get used to saying it because it's weird. So you can drop me an email or you can head over to the website, which is www.inspiredtochange.co.uk, would it be? Yeah, I'm guessing so.
Okay.
I don't know, because you don't have to type it, do you? Normally you just copy, edit and paste it and stick it in.
Yeah, or you just put inspired and then it comes up for you anyway. Whatever it is, we will put it in the description for everyone anyway, so that they can go and click on that. But thank you very much, Ash, for coming on.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. It's been brilliant. Thank you, James. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. It's been a good chat. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, peeps, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Like I say, it was a powerful and kind of harrowing conversation and harrowing story. And I'm really sorry that Asha had to go through that. But ultimately, she's came out the other end. She'd learned from it. And she's now helping others do amazing work. So if you want to work with Asha, don't forget to check out her details in the description below as well. Hopefully, you can use this content in your journey, whether it be personal or professional, to either help yourself or help others. If you are struggling, please reach out to somebody. Come and drop me a message. I'll happily chat with you. Completely free of charge, we'll just chat and whatever you need. And if you want some other support, what we'll do is we'll find some free of charge stuff like Mind and stuff like that, and we will put links in the description as well to a couple of helplines that can help you out. Before you leave us, don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance and the amazing work they're doing if you're looking for a human organizational performance, and don't forget to check out the Learning Organizational webinar as well. Don't forget to check out Project Miletium to get your first month free. There's code in the description, there's codes on the website. Don't forget to check out Rebranding Safety. There's loads of stuff we've been doing, but this year we've just launched our consultancy service. So if you're looking for some help there, go check out that as well. Drop me a message or an email at james@rebrandingsafety.com. I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.